This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. For those listeners who have been listening to us from the beginning, you know that we have been live for the whole time. And so we are making a very slight change to the program now where we are taking voicemail questions only and we're no longer recording live. And so as you've just heard in the new introduction, the voicemail is 714-900-2601. But everything else about the show is exactly the same. So Dr. Hawk is not with us today. She's taking a bit of a break. But Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. All is well, I suppose. It's all is well in my world, but the world's got its turbulence tonight, but things are looking fine.
Yeah, well, the turbulence, we've had a few listeners send us some very excellent questions. So Dr. Lyle, would you like to say something about what's going on today and in the world at present moment?
Yes, actually. And folks, Nathan shared some of these questions that I got a look at earlier today. And I have to tell you, I'm delighted with how intelligent and subtle and objective these questions are. These are really, really interesting questions. Very impressive graduate seminar level thinking, which is what I was always hoping that our little podcast might be able to generate one day, and it has. So, however, this is I'd like to be speculating and thinking through these things with folks tonight. However, this is a time for us to be very sensitive about a very, you know, a touchy situation for many people. And so I think the right thing to do is to examine some of the dynamics of the issues that are going on at a later time when emotions aren't necessarily or won't be nearly as high. The follows a general set of life strategies and clinical strategies that I use that many of you have heard before several times, which is, number one, never make a big decision when a small decision will do. We don't want to leap into things and make big decisions, and so I don't want to have my comments look like I'm taking some kind of a position, when in fact what I'm always attempting to do is just to remain as objective as possible and try to learn. I'm in no way a political figure in any vector at all. What I am is I'm just very curious about human nature, and so my sort of academical detachment that might come across might be offensive, and I wouldn't want that to happen. So the also, if something is such a great idea to do, something that seems exciting or dangerous, etc., it's always a great idea to wait for a while and do it later. So if it seems like the guy is really hot, really exciting, and really cool, you know, and you only just got to know him, and you really feels like it'd be a great idea to have sex with him, I'll tell my clients, if it's such a great idea, it'll be a great idea 3 or 4 weeks from now too. That idea won't go away, and it won't decay. And the same thing is true about the very complicated dynamics that are going on in our country right now. I'm seeing this now on Tuesday evening, on the 2nd of June, and things are quite a bit different and seem much calmer than they were just 48 hours ago. And I'm very grateful to see that that's happening. The reasons for everything that's going on, I believe, are an interplay of many, many different forces. And those will be worth looking at to try to understand and shed light on from an EP perspective at a later time. It's going to turn out when two people are in conflict, two or more people are in conflict, or it could be two large groups, if the conflict is very intense, very serious business, then it's going to turn out that the gene survival mechanisms involved are very sensitive about side-taking. So you'll see this in families or in relationships. When there's a lot on the line, it gets to be very edgy. And if any individual tries to step in the middle to analyze the process without simply taking one side or another of a conflict, it can go very poorly. So this is something that I want to refrain from doing by not getting in the middle of any analysis here at the moment. This is undoubtedly a derivative of our tribal history. So you're either with us or against us. And under very high emotion, high stakes situations, objectivity is not easy to find. And so as a result, I think that all of us that might be interested in whatever light that our little podcast can shed on anything, I think our ability to contribute anything to this discussion for anybody who's interested in listening, our ability to do that is just as good or better later than it is now. So if and when we walk down that road, I won't want to walk it alone. I've got a beautiful, brilliant, favorite political scientist colleague, Dr. Jen Hawk, who, of course, isn't here tonight. and there's a reason she's not here. All people under all circumstances and all animals are simply running cost-benefit analysis on their best interest, no matter how deeply buried or cloaked or unconscious that is. That's what it is. And Dr. Hawk's no exception. It turns out that she dumped us, Nathan. She's got a better deal tonight. So there's something very, very fabulous taking place in Dr. Hawk's life. We'll know more about it soon, I'm sure. But so even though it is fabulous, we can still be irritated because it's inconvenient for us. But we move on. All right. So let's go ahead, Nathan. Let's serve up some good old fashioned Beat Your Genes questions and see what we can learn.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Dr. Lyle, for saying that. My nervous system has been glued to every form of media for the last several days, and mm-hmm. I have been listening to your words in my internal audience to beat my genes, and part of that included installing a very, very difficult content blocker to block the Facebook and block the news and block all the stuff going on, and so that has been helpful. But we will move on to normal Beat Your Genes questions that have been coming in as normal through the website and through the email. So let's just go with it.
All right, all good.
Dear Dr. Lyle, I love how you often advise individuals to overcome motivational barriers like the ego trap through lowering the cost of trying and failing. Mm-hmm. This has made a lot of sense when you've talked about Carol Dweck's work in her book, Mindset. Mm-hmm. What I'm struggling with is how this lines up with Robert Plomin's work in his book, Blueprint. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I come from a family of low-lifes, junkies, and drug addicts. I was able to be the first person in my family to get a college degree of any kind, and am looking at pursuing a PhD. I'm willing to believe this might be reaching on my part and I might fail, but it seems worthwhile to try. If I were to look at my genetics, it makes me think that I'm doomed to become a drug addict who accomplishes nothing. Wouldn't it be more useful to have a growth mindset about your abilities and let the environment then tell you where you're reaching out of your league? If I'm being honest, the genetics perspective just makes me feel hopeless, where my lived experience does not. How can I more usefully incorporate this perspective to help fuel my achievement rather than a fixed mindset of my own abilities as determined by my genetics?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Deep thinking, graduate seminar, just what I was saying. The All right. It's a fabulous question. Let's review quickly first what the questioner is asking so that people understand. The Carol Dweck, who may or may not still be the head of the Department of Psychology at Stanford University, has a major theory that she devised called mindset. And the notion of mindset theory is that if you have a growth mindset, it means that that you feel like you are, that you're not just great at something, and so you don't have to, you're not resting on your laurels. You feel like you are growing and getting better, and therefore you are more motivated. Whereas if you have a fixed mindset and the notion that you are what you are and you can't change that, then that would be demotivating. And so Dweck, basically any study she ever ran on this sort of works perfectly. In other words, that if you tell people things like, well, you're really making an improvement here, you know, a good job, then a kid works harder. Whereas if you tell a kid, hey, you're great at this, then they don't. Okay, they will stop and they'll freeze and they won't want to do the next set of problems. Now, she thinks it's a growth versus fixed mindset. When I first read Dweck, I was quite fascinated that her experiments worked so beautifully and yet she didn't understand what was happening. So by the time she had written this, or the time I was aware of it, I had already analyzed the problem. Dweck's analysis does not involve evolutionary psychology, so she's not thinking in terms of adaptive mechanisms. So there'd be no way that she would understand that when she sees the resistance of the, quote, fixed mindset, that she actually mentions, she throws the word around in an early chapter saying, well, it's just about ego or something. Well, little did she know that I use the word ego to stand for the notion of an esteem meter, or a monitoring device looking for esteem signals or status. And so, and that's a loose term that's used in the just common vernacular. And so that's how she was using it. And it turns out, little did she know how right she was. It is about ego, but it's not, ego is not a silly thing, and it's not an immature thing or disgusting thing or anything else. The ego is or what we call ego is actually the operations of an esteem sensing mechanism, what I call the esteem meter. And there's a trap that is evident in motivation, a self-destructive trap of procrastination and avoidance that I have termed the ego trap. And the ego trap takes place when the benefits of essentially staying on the sideline and not trying out are better than the alternative action, which is to try your best and fail. So if you overly praise people and tell them how great they are, they're not in a, quote, fixed mindset. Nothing of the kind is taking place there. What's taking place is a cost-benefit analysis that the individual analyzes that you think they are fancier or more capable than they think than they themselves believe that they are. And so as a result, it's in their best interests genetically under those circumstances to understand that it is the right thing to do is to procrastinate and avoid and not demonstrate that you are in fact incorrect as an observer and that they are not as good as you think they are. They want to hold on to the status, i.e. what's happening is the activation of the status sensing mechanism, or what I call the esteem meter or ego. That mechanism is signaling with an overall CB that this is not in your best interest. Yeah, there's nothing about this that's, quote, a fixed mindset, okay? So mindset theory at its core will, at a superficial level, it will demonstrate short-term little experiments that if you do them just right, it will appears to confirm the theory. But the notion that there are two mindsets and that the mindsets are inherently flexible and that you can choose one or the other is just utterly absurd. There's no truth in it at all. As a result, any long-term effort to try to get anybody to change their mindset and therefore change their general attack on problems with respect to any motivational dilemma turns out to be zero. Mindset theory is a total, utter, long-term, complete failure. There's no use to it. Okay, now. So then we wind up at Robert Plumman. In other words, mindset theory, the notion that you could change things and it would change your trajectory substantially, is incorrect. And Robert Plumman is right, and he's got the data, and genes are largely destiny. Okay, now, where does that leave us? Well, we're here to beat the genes, okay? So we're here to think clinically, looking at these two different perspectives. We're here to say, okay, well, what can you change? And what you can change is the following, that you can actually learn about the actual mechanics of the ego trap. Because the ego trap is not death and it's not inevitable. It's simply a cost-benefit analysis dynamic. That's why the name of my website and our approach, Jen's and my approach, is Esteem Dynamics. It's the notion that esteem processes are dynamic. They're never static. If they look static, it's only because the force field, the sum total of cost-benefit analysis that are involved in the system are largely static. Okay, it's not because esteem processes are inherently static. They're inherently dynamic. In other words, they are responsive to environmental changes. So you can't change your general personality structure about how inherently optimistic or risk-taking or anything else you are. Those are embedded in the genetic code. But when you find yourself in circumstances where you are essentially procrastinating and avoiding challenge, then you cannot snap your fingers and scold yourself into a growth mindset. That is not possible. What you can do is that you can actually discover through the analysis of understanding the dynamics of how your mind works, that you have been, by environmental cues, you have gotten yourself worked into a situation where it appears that the benefit of procrastinating and avoidance is exceeding the cost. And the truth is that that is usually incorrect. It is superficially true only in some short-term limited basis, only from a variety, you know, some particular perspective or some particular consciousness that we're attempting to bluff. But it is not in your long-term best interest. So you can understand in principle how to deactivate the ego trap by understanding the true mechanics of how it works and why it works the way it works. You cannot then generally apply it to your life as a general process. That never works. It's never true. No change that anybody ever makes is on a general level at all, because that would be personality. No, what you can do is you can change on highly specific, very domain narrow problems. When your particular personality and circumstances have arrived at the cost-benefit analysis that leads you into the non-competitive procrastinating delay that we call the ego trap. I now know, for example, I can feel the ego trap in myself when it happens. I can recognize the feeling. I can also recognize it in others by cross-examining them and watching them. And so as a result, I know what that feeling feels like. I recognize it and I understand its process. So therefore, I can actually also understand how on earth I need to grit my teeth, look at the fundamentals, be willing to sacrifice the short-term status loss at surprising, you know, somebody's surprising observation of my relatively poor performance relative to what they thought I was going to be able to do, and grind my way through the ego trap and to get out of it to get to the other side of it. Okay, so that's why criticism to Carol Dweck. Carol Dweck is a classically trained social scientist looking at things from a learning theory perspective. She's not aware really of the depth of knowledge and information and absolutely airtight lock on the truth that behavior genetics has. So as a result, she also is an experimental scientist. She has an experimental paradigm that works. If you had such a paradigm that worked so beautifully, you would think that it had greater long-term range and power and that it could be a domain general learning process. It's clear from reading her book that she thinks it's domain general. And so within her own family, they kind of scold each other and monitor each other to keep a growth mindset instead of a fixed mindset. It's like, it's not possible. Okay. That's the story. These are Dweck and Plumman are on sort of looking at different aspects of it. Ploman has the broad domain general data of the nature of personality and how incredibly useful that understanding could be. But that does not mean we are trapped and we cannot actually improve our situations. You cannot change your personality, but you can absolutely change your situation. And the way you change your situation is by getting more information. Your all of your thoughts, feelings, and behavior take place as an interaction between information that comes into the system interacting with two different databases, one of which is that your learning history specifically, and the other one is your personal genetically built nervous system as well. Those are two sources of variation why individual behavior is different from person to person, and also why it's different from one person within their own lifetime at different locations in time. That's because the estimation of the environment changes with experience. So therefore now, instead of when I would have been 20 years old facing the ego trap, I would have retreated instinctually from the cues that it would be giving me in order to stay away from the competitive problem, hold on to the status as long as possible, and avoid the challenge. That is the genetic prescription for that. It is not self-destructive per se. It's an evolutionary devised strategy, okay? However, it is not necessarily the optimum strategy in all conditions. In fact, it's usually not the optimal strategy if we understand how it is that we can get out of it, okay? That understanding is not obvious at all. And so now that it's been clearly understood, and I know that it is now understood clearly by us here, we can actually step by step take people through the stepping stones that are necessary to get out of the trap. You can learn that is a domain general strategy, by the way. So understanding how the ego trap is, once you understand that is a domain general understanding of the nervous system. You then take that domain general understanding, and you can apply it quite specifically to every problem that a person faces where that's tugging at their nervous system and making their life less than it could be.
It's fascinating to hear you talk about this, Dr. Lyle. And I remember I'm going to ask you for another example of an ego trap in your clinical practice. But I remember the first time you talked about this on the show, where you described the angst of a, I believe it was a carpenter or a construction worker who believed that he was supposed to make more than he had ever thought he could make, and that was stopping him from going out and actually looking for a job and facing the reality that maybe he couldn't, maybe he wouldn't get paid as much. Right. But do you have other examples? Maybe I didn't report it right, but do you have other examples? Can you share with us maybe a story that comes to mind of a patient who was also in an ego trap?
I just, what leaps to mind for me, I mean, there's been 1,000. It's a common dilemma for people to be in, particularly when they're picking up a phone trying to talk to a psychologist, because they're in psychic pain, they're in distress and conflict because of failure in a competitive domain. And one of the things that's happening is they're procrastinating and not moving forward, and they can't understand why. So there's been 1,000 of those that we could talk about with respect to, for example, weight loss, healthy diet, getting an exercise program together, or anything else under the sun like that. But what leaps to mind for me, as you just mentioned that and say, I can think of several. But one of them that I've told about before was I had given this presentation many years ago, probably in the early 2000s, at an advanced study weekend for John McDougall. And this handsome, elegant, athletic man of in his mid-60s came up to me afterwards and said to the effect, "Oh my God, now I understand something incredibly important in my life." And I said, "Well, tell me the story." And he said, "For 16 years, I was the number one tennis player in my tennis club. I was always ranked number one. But I did not ever play in our annual tournament. And I didn't do it because I was terrified of being beaten." And he says, I played in other clubs tournaments. I did all kinds of stuff. I won a lot of stuff, but I never played in my own clubs tournament. And I just made it a policy. No, I don't play in the clubs tournament. And he said, it was all ego trap. And I felt terrible about it. It made me sick. I was bluffing everybody like I didn't care. But really, I was just afraid of losing. And he says, now that I see this, I just should have played. He says, I would have lost some, but I would have won some. And right now I'd have, you know, half a dozen trophies on my shelf that I don't have and a bunch of memories. And it just would have been so much better. It was such a weird life. All those years in my club, somehow the, you know, me being number one and never playing in the tournament, he goes, I thank you. Because now I understand why I did what I did. I couldn't understand it. So that's an example of the ego trap in a very, very static looking social dynamic, where the ego trap got put in place and was able to stay there for essentially a lifetime or a huge chunk of a lifetime, and caused a challenge avoidance that impoverished this man's existence. And in a way, his life was less than it would have been. He has a great life, but he had some pain and some confusion about his own behavior and why that took place that he then finally was able to understand. This is, you know, one day somebody will take the concept of the ego trap and they'll go back and they'll look at the most likely to succeed. And it will be an interesting study to look at, you know, 3,000 of our best and brightest, you know, high school students that get voted that honor, and then track what happens to their lives and see whether or not we have evidence of some major avoidance of effort that is semi-tragic in nature. I don't really have any doubt about it that there is an influence in that regard to some degree. So what would Robert Plowman say about that? He would say, yeah, their lives were probably pretty similar to what they would have been. And I would add, yes, but this life experience of having expectations sort of permanently and shiningly put on you that were, you know, crushing, I'll bet you that their lives were less than they would have otherwise been in most cases. So that's what I would say about that.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Lyle, you know, you've said this recently, actually, relative to how many shows we have, but it's been stuck in my mind since then. And when I find myself in what I believe is an ego trap, I keep trying to tell myself that the next best thing to playing and winning is playing and losing.
There you go. Absolutely.
All right, Dr. Lyle. Well, our next question. All right, dear Dr. Lyle, I'm noticing that despite the evidence that is widely available, people who should not be personally overly fearful of the coronavirus are in fact quite fearful. Now, you have discussed many possibilities for this, including a reason for maybe opting out of competition and the like, but I'm curious if what we're seeing is nervous systems intentionally generating personal levels of fear in order to maintain or obtain status. It feels as though it is seen as low status, low conscientious, low compassion, etc. behavior to disregard the coronavirus as a threat. And it seems people's internal audience is generating fear in order to obtain compliance and preserve status. I'm curious if you think the area of the nervous system that is responsible for maintaining status is always competing with other areas of the nervous system and will have to trick its competition in order to fulfill its goals. And that the best way to do that in the case of the coronavirus is to create the impression that this thing is a personal threat.
Fascinating thinking. There's a problem. There's a little bit of a problem with this. The person is the questioner has sort of they have entered into a hybrid land where there's some psychodynamic thinking involved here. But there's good thinking and there's creative thinking, and then it's being tinged with some, with at least in the way the language is being used, some sort of, there's a little psychodynamic magic that's being thrown in the sauce. Now, so for example, would it be possible that the nervous system could know that it's really somehow aiming at status? So in order to get the status, it needs to generate the fear, which will generate the compliance, which will generate the status. No. No, the nervous system could never be constructed that way. It's instead, what you could see is you could see something that halfway looks like that and maps onto it in terms of a data sheet. So it looks like this. A highly conscientious person picks up the social cues that wearing a mask is a good thing. Now, they aren't thinking necessarily. The reason why they're wearing the mask primarily is they have anxiety about the virus. You might say, well, objectively, they shouldn't be anxious about the virus. But that's the whole point of being highly conscientious, is that when we say highly conscientious, we mean above the conscientiousness of the middle of the bell curve. So by definition, anybody that's above the above the middle of the conscientiousness midline is sort of typically distorted in the direction of overestimating the worst case scenario. The person that sits at the middle of the bell curve has a nervous system that has been shaped by evolutionary processes to actually optimize the risk-reward ratios with respect to threats. That's why that gene is more successful in the gene pool than every other gene on the bell curve of that dimension. Okay, so the hyper-conscientious person is a person who is dealing with a nervous system that is going to be typically over-investing in prophylactic measures to reduce the likelihood of loss. No problem. It's not a disaster. If you're a little bit more conscientious than average, then all is fine. If you get to be super hyper-conscientious, then we can get all the way to you washing your hands 87 times a day. And we can really see now that you are overestimating and you're wasting time and energy in a way that's vastly reducing your likelihood of broad-term, broad-spectrum defined biological success. Anybody that's got an OCD tendency in the Stone Age is not doing nearly as much romance and sex as the guy that is doing a lot less of the OCD rituals. Okay? So the way this works is the hyper-conscientious individual who's wearing a mask is wearing a mask because they're hyper-conscientious and they're worried about infection. All's fair and honest. Now they also look around, and they're probably not just hyper-conscientious about infection. They're hyper-conscientious more generally because it's the same suite of genes that's driving the hyper-conscientiousness just in general. So as a result, one of the things they're conscientious about is about social status. Okay, so they want to make sure that they are being viewed as in a very positive light for being highly responsible. So now that adds to the equation. So it's the high conscientiousness that's driving both of these things, not a fancy thing about, hey, what I want is status. Of course they want status, but the status isn't through some back channel fascinating mechanism trying to generate fear so that they will be more conscientious and wear the mask. No, it's a more direct, broad spectrum direction of the genes that lead to hyper-conscientious thought, feeling, and behavior are generally directing the behavior on both dimensions. Number one, be careful, and number two, let everybody know that you're being careful. So that's how that's working.
Wonderful. One of the listeners sent me a picture and says, yeah, if this is how average people wear masks, it's no surprise why we have so many unplanned pregnancies.
Okay. All right. What do we got next, Nathan?
All right. Our next question. Dear Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, but Dr. Lyle, I guess you're here.
Mm-hmm, I'm here.
Yeah. I'm wondering what advice you have for people that may have inherited a lot of money or won the lottery. How can this affect the self-esteem mechanism, and what's the best way to handle the money to achieve happiness?
Yeah, great question. and let's look at, we can immediately see the possibility, for example, we were just talking about the ego trap, and you can see how under certain conditions the person could be ego trapped very easily. They bring with them the trappings of success. Other people could believe that they would be inherently better genetic quality than they are, and that it could lead to some reticence with respect to taking on a diverse types of challenges. So isn't necessarily the case, but I could see how that could happen very easily. As a result, through that mechanism and also through the mechanism of just straight path of least resistance, that just through the energy conservation mechanism, an individual is not in a natural set of circumstances potentially. They're actually not in a natural set of circumstances. So if I get lost, Nathan, just mark that a little bit. We're talking about natural sets of circumstances and motivation. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. One of the things that I observe fairly commonly is the mother of a teenager or early 20-something calling me up worried about their essentially lazy young man who is playing video games all day, eating Cheetos, and doesn't leave his room, doesn't even seem to interact with any real friends, and doesn't do very well in school or isn't in school and doesn't have a job, but we don't know what to do with him, and we're just worried because he's failing to thrive, okay? And the problem is that we have an animal in a zoo, and animals in a zoo aren't very happy because they come around and throw a steak at the tiger at 4 o'clock every day, and that the tiger isn't then able to do the things the tigers do. So therefore, they lack skill, they lack muscle tone. In other words, they are essentially becoming a less competent animal. And they don't get evidence of their capabilities. So when this happens to humans, it's not good. It results in sort of a low-grade malaise. The self-esteem mechanism is watching this, and it's kind of rolling its eyes at the lack of achievement if the individual is being essentially self-indulgent, which it isn't every inherited wealth person doesn't do this, but they might do it. And they might do it for numerous reasons. Number one, just being sort of inherently lazy. Or number two, could be ego-trapped. So there's reasons why this could take place. Pretty good reasons why it could take place. Now, so the wealthy potential kid is not really seeing what good it's going to do them to work if they've got, you know, $5 million in the bank and it's generating $250,000 a year. It's like, what the heck's the point? Okay. And so as a result, they're unmotivated, they're an animal in a zoo, and their nervous system is not actually under natural ecological conditions. And you might say, well, are any nervous systems under natural ecological conditions? And the answer is yes. The natural ecological conditions are that you need to make efforts in the world in order to get resources in order to survive and reproduce. So every 15-year-old boy knows that if he's not going to be given a fancy car, he's going to want to get one. And in order to get one, he's going to have to hustle, and he's going to have to be effective at commerce and get his money together so that he can get a car, so that he can go on a date, so that he can get laid. Okay? So this is the causal pathway that's associated with generating motivation. And if we sever that pathway, that the person is not in deprivation for resources that would be useful for a variety of problems, then we have undermined that individual's motivation. So the question is, what do you do if you're such an individual? Now, some individuals in those circumstances don't have any problem at all. They are inherently motivated to rise in dominance hierarchies, take on challenges, and they may do all kinds of a variety of things in order to do that. No problem. They're not suffering from the low achievement and challenge malaise associated with inherited wealth. But if you are such an individual and you feel the sort of vague, creeping feeling of malaise, that life doesn't have excitement other than thrill, okay? there's no sense of self-esteem and achievement because we're not bothering because it's a little too much trouble and it's a little too difficult and we don't have to do it anyway. Okay. We may feel ego trapped, slightly embarrassed. And when time goes by, we actually feel that it's a little bit more embarrassing and a little bit more embarrassing as it's not a big deal at 19 to have no income producing skill. But when you're 32, it's a little bit more of an embarrassing issue. Okay. What do you say to potential new romantic partners when they ask you what you do for a living? What have you accomplished? Okay. So this is the issue. So what do you do about it? Okay. Well, this is why all of these things have to be resolved on the individual level of analysis. So every person's different and every set of circumstances are different. So every person that may face this may well be able to use some wise counsel and to be willing to run experiments to find out whether or not it's worth it to them to make any changes. I can remember a long time ago that I had a client that had these circumstances, and he was a middle-aged guy, had been essentially pretty lazy and self-indulgent his whole life. And then he came into some money, and he continued to be lazy and indulgent. But he came to me, and he was troubled by this and didn't know what to do. And, you know, I came up with a variety of ideas and possibilities, etc. But he's what Dr. Hawk and I call a Plowman special. In other words, there wasn't going to be any change. he lived his life knowing that he was going to get some money, and he lived it in such a way as to be as energy conserving as possible. And then when he got the money, it continued. And I could tell that the emotional tone of his life never was one of, he essentially lived his whole life as an animal in a zoo. So if you're an animal in a zoo and you can feel that you are, and life doesn't have the feeling of an adventure and achievement to it, that despite a world of opportunity and not having to be on the factory floor like so many other people in the world having no choices, but you have a wide variety of choices, yet you feel the animal in a zoo malaise, then, you know, get some counsel, take some chances, and try to follow the faint threads of excitement in your nervous system. And if you feel ego trapped behind them, you know, try to take what we try to explain here about how to power your way through that so that you can get into a feedback loop where the excitement of achievement becomes a self-generating, motivating force. And that's how we're going to try to move a person out from under those kinds of strange burdens.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, it's interesting. I was reading about lions in the zoo, and it turns out that researchers, when they put them under a fasting schedule, their mood improves. They start pacing. They start exhibiting behaviors as though they're out in the wild, and they're starting to do that. Now, they're postulating because it's the fast, but from what you're saying, Dr. Lyle, and it makes perfect sense that now they don't know if they're getting food, so then now they're starting to pace back and forth and start to activate some of those instincts that make them happy.
A little bit of deprivation. You're supposed to be deprived. Yeah, your life is supposed to be one of not having as many resources as you would like. Okay, that is the natural state of the organism, and so it's a state of essentially, it's deprivation, action, satiation, deprivation, action, satiation. That's the natural process of an animal. And so you can see if we never have deprivation, that deprivation very often then becomes thrill seeking behind the pleasure trap. And that's an understandable derivative often of being given things that we didn't earn.
Wow. Can you expand on that a little bit? You just blew my mind. And even though it was all over your pleasure trap book about, you know, the scarcity is the name of the game in nature, but I'd love to hear you wind out a little bit more on this if you'd like.
I can't think of anything. Okay. This is a time for Jen, and she's not here because she's having a really good time.
Very happy for her.
Okay.
All right. Nathan. Well, I think we've had enough for today, Dr. Lyle. What do you think?
All good. Fantastic. We'll see if we can get our social pressure together and get her back here next week.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, I'll try to send her like 72 texts between now and next week.
That's good. All right, folks. Well, very glad to have people with us, and let's just hope that our world gets better and better, just one day at a time.
Very good, Dr. Lau. Thank you so much for your words of wisdom, and we will look forward to talking with you next week.
Fantastic. Thank you, Nathan.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.